KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. China is listed as a country with one of the highest rates of suicide, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Mental health services often carry a stigma, though that's starting to change. The government recently passed the country's first national mental health law. Michael Phillips has lived and worked in China since 1985, at the end of the Cultural Revolution. He discussed China's mental health landscape at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15th, 2013.
It's really an honor to be here, and it'd be great. And I really am glad I have the opportunity to share some of the enthusiasm that I felt being a participant and observer in China over the last 30 years. The changes have been traumatic and exciting, and at times very frightening, but they've never been boring. And so it's been a real exciting ride for me, and I'm hoping to convey some of the excitement of the rapid change that's been happening in China during my talk tonight. First, I'll give a small overview of the history, as I see it, of mental health in China. Of course, everybody will look at it in different ways, and they'll divide it up in different ways. But this is how I envisage the process of the evolution of health service, mental health services in the country. First, in the Republican era, which was before liberation in 1949, there were a number of missionary hospitals, psychiatric hospitals. The first was built in 1898 in Canton. And by liberation in 1949, there's probably about 11 psychiatric hospitals in the large cities around the country, most of which were supported by missionary groups in the West. Then, after liberation, this 49 to 65 period, there was substantial influence from Russia. So most of the psychiatric services were focused on Luria's model of neuropsychology. This resulted in the building of some psychiatric hospitals. But over this period, many medical schools opened up in the country. But psychiatry, because it's relatively low status in Russia, was also very low status. So as the medical schools evolved, psychiatry wasn't really evident in the disciplines that were trained. Then during the Cultural Revolution era, the ideologic institutions took over. And the psychiatric hospitals that were available basically closed down, or they stopped providing any treatment or medication, and the treatment for mental illness was to read Mao's Little Red Book. And literally you would have groups of people talking about Mao's Little Red Book and the ideology, and that was how they were supposed to improve their psychoses. And that lasted throughout the Cultural Revolution era. Many psychiatrists were put out of work, or the hospitals were closed, and those that did remain open only used this type of indoctrination method to treat mental illnesses. The early reform era, after Deng Xiaoping came in, returned to power in 1978, there was a gradual return to sort of more Western-style psychiatric services. The psychiatric hospitals opened again. They started to use medication. But it was a gradual process because psychiatry was still the low man on the totem pole. Psychiatry was seen as a small brother of the neurology, and so there was little influence in the health sector, though psychiatric services were developing over this early reform era. The late reform era, there was a lot more contact with the West. There was international relationships. Drug companies started to move in and sell more modern antipsychotic and antidepressant drugs. And so over this period, there was a rapid increase of change with the West, and there was more exchange with psychiatrists going from China to America and Europe. And this was an era of really rapid development and westernization of the mental health system. Another big change happened after SARS. SARS was a wake-up call for China. It demonstrated how important public health is. And before, public health hadn't received a substantial amount of resources from the government. But SARS, because of the international pressure on China, because of it, the potential of infecting the world, China's public health system was strongly invigorated after SARS. The government put huge amounts of money into public health. And as part of that process, mental illnesses became identified as a public health problem, not something that just happens in those crazy people off in psychiatric hospitals, but it became identified as a major mental health problem. And one of the factors that influenced this was the global burden of disease studies that were done with Chris Murray's group, who's now here at University of Washington. And that was a major factor that transitioned psychiatry into being seen as a public health problem. More recently, we've just passed the first national mental health law. And this is really a revolutionary law. It's taken 27 years for us to generate this law. It has a number of statutes that really go beyond what's done in the West in terms of providing services, dealing with stigma, what the family responsibility is, moving people from involuntary to voluntary admissions. And it's a new starting point for mental health. And it's really exciting that the elements that are in this law and the it's going to take a while to implement. It'll probably be decades before all the specific statutes in it are actually implemented. But this is another new start for us in mental health. It's actually extremely exciting, the future of mental health in China. But that's at least how I divide up the historical pattern. Now, I started in 1976, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and in my Mao jacket. So I showed up on the scene in 1976. And so I was first came to China at the tail end of the Cultural Revolution. Mao Zedong was still alive when I arrived. And then I went to the Languages Institute in Beijing. And about a month after I arrived, we were all marched down to Tiananmen Square. And there was a big kerfuffle. I didn't know what it was. By then, I could maybe count to 10. And I didn't know what was going on. But there was a million people shouting at the top of their lungs. And so I knew something important was happening. And what it was a fall of the Gang of Four. And this was really a historical moment. You knew you were in the middle of a historical moment. Now, I was there. I didn't know what was going on, but I was there. And it's exciting to see the changes that have happened since that time. I was supposed to go to a school of public health after my first year of studying language, but they didn't let me, so I went to Nanjing to continue studying Chinese. But after those 2 years, I knew I was going to come back to China. I knew there was, especially after Deng Xiaoping came back in power, there were going to be opportunities here. Things were going to move fast. And as a foreigner, there would be a place where I could make a contribution and I could make my mark. And so I'd already decided after 2 years of studying Chinese that I was going to come back. But I had to get some skills to do this. I had to have something to contribute. So I came here and I did my residency in psychiatry, I did my degree in public health, and a degree in anthropology. And those were skills that were extremely useful to me in my subsequent work in China. But when I came to Seattle, I already knew I was going to go back, but I wanted to gain skills that I would be able to apply when I returned. I first returned to Changsha as an exchange fellow. I was there for 2 years and I worked primarily with schizophrenia and the families of schizophrenics. But I wanted a real job because, you know, I was just an exchange fellow like many other exchange fellows. And it was hard because at that time, foreigners just didn't get real jobs with Chinese institutions. It just didn't happen. But there was two mental health systems, or actually three systems of psychiatric hospitals in China at the time. One in the Ministry of Health, one in the Ministry of Civil Affairs, which was slightly slower status, but had about 300 psychiatric hospitals around the country, mostly chronic care. Some veterans were there. And then there was also a small number of hospitals under public security for forensic psychiatry. And the head of the training center for the Ministry of Civil Affairs hospitals was a guy who's willing to take risks. And so I traded off my skills as a researcher with the requirement to give me a real job. And so we negotiated back and forth. And so they decided that he'd give me a job as the head of a clinical epidemiology research center. So I now had a formal job in a Chinese institution, which at that time was unheard of. And over this period, what I was doing, I was going around the country training research methodology, things that I'd learned while Robert Wood Johnson Fellow and a master's epidemiology student here in Washington, in University of Washington. We were in Shashu, and my wife came and decided she'd hang out with me for a while. And we ran a ward, a psychiatric ward, a 90-patient psychiatric ward for about a year and a half, and did open the first family association for the mentally ill in China. Because of the stigma, families aren't willing to kind of be active in promoting mental health services. And so we have nothing in China like NAMI, which is really an important actor. But I started the first family association, and I continued to do quite a bit of research in families. Then subsequently moved to Beijing, where we were at the Huilongguan Hospital for 15 years, and over the last 3 years have been in Shanghai. So I've been there over this period of multiple changes in the mental health system. And I'm going to walk you through some of those, if I can. Okay, the first period is psychotic psychiatry. And why we call it psychotic psychiatry? Because initially in China, psychiatry is only for the schizophrenics and, you know, people who have run-of-the-mill depression. They're never going to go to mental health services. It was basically all for psychotic treatment. And so the hospitals were simply based, where almost 85% of the hospital patients were schizophrenics or other psychotic illnesses. At that time, the problem in the mental health system was that there were few services in rural areas. Urban services were focused on specialty hospitals. There were no incentives to provide community services. The low status of mental health professionals, we have lots of experiences. We had competitions within between hospitals in our cities. And all the other hospitals, you know, the general, the cancer hospital, the general hospital, all the competitors who were doctors and nurses from the hospital would blaze in the name of their hospital on their jerseys as they were running or participating in these sports events. Docs and nurses from our hospital didn't want anything on their journey because they didn't want anybody knowing they're working in a psychiatric hospital. Because if they did, then they'd have a trouble finding a spouse. That was the level of stigma that it meant to kind of work in psychiatry at the time. A lot of young people came to me as psychiatrists. They'd do anything to go and work as neurology or become a psychologist, but anything but psychiatry. So stigma was really a substantial problem. No organized family movement, as I mentioned. Lack of a legal framework for the protection and supervision of mentally ill. Difficult to implement cross-sectoral strategies. Administrative structure, managing service was ineffective. There were three systems: Ministry of Health, Ministry of Civil Affairs, Ministry of Public Security, and there's no interaction between them. And low quality of mental health services research. There wasn't really any quality research. Again, psychiatry at the time was a little brother to neurology. And in the medical schools, they had no training about psychiatry. So it really was a disparaged specialty. Nonetheless, psychiatric rehabilitation had become important over this period. And I was able to get people from different parts of the country to write articles about the status of psychiatric rehabilitation in China, and was able to publish a special issue, a supplement of the British Journal about psychiatric rehabilitation. Now, a couple years before this actually came out, I and my wife took about 27 psychiatrists to Hong Kong to present their results on this rehabilitation. This is the largest group of psychiatrists ever to leave the country by this time. And we walked them through the border stop in Shenzhen and kind of brought them out to the meeting. At that time, it was very uncommon to go overseas, and going to Hong Kong was considered overseas. So people, all the psychiatrists around the country who participated in this meeting that I'd organized, got 300 yuan, about $50, to buy a new suit so they could present themselves well to the foreigner participants, show that China is not poor, China has people who can dress well in good suits. And so as Marlis and I were walking this long line of penguins in their new suits across the border, and they all had the label of the new suit right prominently displayed to show that they had a new suit. Then the next big thing happened was, out of the blue it seemed, the Ministry of Health started to release the mortality data to the World Health Organization. This is kind of 1994, they started to release data from 1987 onwards. And they don't have a national mortality system, but they actually release data to the World Health Organization. And lo and behold, this data was startling in terms of schizophrenia, in terms of suicide, because before that, it was illegal to write on suicide, to talk about suicide, to publish in the public press. It was just impossible. But this mortality data included information on suicide. And so all of a sudden, suicide was opened up as a possibility to research and to study. Because before that, it was literally, because suicide was seen as a reflection on poor governance. And therefore, people were unwilling, and the government was very uncomfortable that anybody publishing or researching this area couldn't do anything about it. But when the death mortality data was presented to the WHO, the suicide was in there, and that allowed us to look at suicide. And as a person As a psychiatrist, an anthropologist, an epidemiologist, it was ideal for me. And they opened that door just a little, and boy, I charged right through. I mean, this is what was set for me. And I really was delighted that enough openness had occurred, largely because Deng Xiaoping and the reform era, that suicide was now okay to talk about. And as you can see, the publication subsequently increased dramatically. But before that, it was illegal to write on suicide. So looking at the data also was startling. This is the data in the World Health Organization, publicly data the Chinese gave to them. And amazing, I mean, 35% of rural females who die in the age of 15 to 25 were suicides. It was just startling, the numbers. And this is what they had provided to the World Health Organization. So I wasn't cooking anything. And so this was, and I kind of adapted the data to population weights and stuff and published in The Lancet in 2002, and there was a substantial amount of discomfort about this, and there's a question about whether or not I was going to be kicked out of the country because I published this data. But I was using their own data, and I'd say made some adjustments to it. And finally they agreed, yeah, he hadn't cooked up data, he used our own data, and so they allowed me to stay. But this data showed, one, at that time, huge rates. And here's the pattern by urban and rural and male and female. And there were two things that just didn't match with what was known in suicide in the West. One, rural rates were 3 times urban rates. Nobody had ever reported that. And this is the largest country in the world, so that seems to be important. And also, with this huge peak of female suicides in rural areas, there were actually more female suicides than male suicides, where previously all research everywhere that had been published said there's 3 times as many men as women who die. So this just didn't fit. And so that was quite interesting from the perspective of Lancet, and clearly required some research. Because this is what the WHO had said for decades, and you still can get that on their website, that every age group around the world, men are 3 times as likely to die from suicide as women. It's simply wrong, but that's what the data from China was able to demonstrate over time. So based on that first paper from the Lancet, I was able to negotiate with the Chinese CDC to do a psychological autopsy study, which is you go after the suicide happens, you go and talk to families to figure out what the causes are. This turned out to be, we did a 23-site study around the country. It was the largest and remains the largest case-controlled psychological autopsy study ever done anywhere. We had a total of 895 suicides and had accidental deaths as our control group. And this is the largest, I'd say, ever done. I coordinated with the Chinese CDC. And it also found some startling results. First and most important, and the suicidologists remain very dubious about this, but I now have confirmatory data, 33% of people who die of suicide did not have a mental illness. At that time, the assumption was, if you suicide, you have to have had a mental illness. It was sort of assumed. But our data, which was a good quality psychological autopsy study, sort of contradicted that. So that was kind of strange. And in fact, I present this to suicide meetings all the time, and the West, oh, you missed the diagnosis, you did this wrong or that wrong. But we now have confirmatory studies that demonstrate that this is in fact true. And when we looked at attempted suicides in emergency rooms, 60%, if you include, or 50 to 60% do not have a mental illness. And that was just anathema to Western suicidologists, said you just can't be right. You know, there's just it's not possible. And because they'd done all these studies and all these other countries to demonstrate that it was, everybody had mental illness. So why are there so many non-mental illness suicides? Well, in China, a lot of suicides are really not premeditated. They're impulsive. And we looked at serious suicide attempts seen in emergency rooms, and 37% said the time between when they first thought of suicide to when they acted was less than 5 minutes. That's impulsive. And 46% said less than 10 minutes. And that also says, is a mental health intervention really going to address this? Now, what are you going to, that's not something that providing better mental health care is going to get to. And so that raised a lot of questions about what had been assumed to be normal. The other big issue was 58% of all the suicides were by pesticides. If at that time you'd asked suicidologists around the world what was the most common method of suicide, they'd never think of pesticide. In fact, globally, pesticide is by far the number one cause of method of suicide. And the data from China demonstrated that. That was sort of a new finding that made people rethink about suicide. And this method also affected the gender and age distribution of the completed suicides. And based on this, I developed my own model, which put mental health in there, and certainly mental health is important, but it isn't the driving factor. And it's a more sociologic model that looks at different levels. I don't have time to go through this, but this was the model I developed based on this research. And because of that research, which also got in Lancet, which gets a lot of, which carries weight in China, I was able over a couple of years to establish the WHO Collaborating Center for Research and Training in Suicide Prevention. There's only the third in the world. There is one in Australia, one in Sweden, and ours. So this was like a big deal for China to have its own suicide prevention center, WHO Collaborating Center. So over a couple of years with this Collaborating Center, we had to do some rethinking about suicide. This is the recent publication, the Global Burden Disease Study, which has just come out last December with Chris Murray's group. And based on that data, there's 880,000 suicides in the world, and only 16% come from high-income countries. But 95% of the research about suicide that tells what's the model of suicide, what are the interventions we should be doing, is based on this 16%. And the question is, how relevant is that for the 84% that happen in low-income countries? And my answer is not that relevant. It's not irrelevant, but there's a lot of issues that are clearly different, and there's a lot of lessons that the high-income countries could learn from how suicide manifests and should be prevented in low-income countries. But all the research and the assumed given truths about suicide come from research in the 16% of the suicides occur in high-income countries. So, that data from low- and middle-income countries are challenging many of the conventional wisdoms that have been held for decades among suicidologists. One, rapid urbanization does not necessarily lead to increased rates. Based on Durkheim and original theories of suicide, urbanization, ennui, breakdown of families should have more suicide. Well, it doesn't prove true. Heavy predominance of male suicides is not seen in China and other Asian countries. Mental illness is not a precondition for suicidal behavior. Lower suicidal intent is not necessarily associated with less lethal types of suicidal behavior. In fact, a lot of people who use pesticide have low intent. They don't really want to die, but they use very lethal means so they end up dead. So that connection between lethality and death and intent isn't as strong as it's supposed to be in the West. So people who have low intent, who don't really intend to die, they're doing it as a social act, often die because they use very lethal means. The psychological valence of risk and protective factors such as divorce and religious affiliation are context and time dependent. At certain periods of time, surprisingly, divorce was a protective factor for suicide. Now, that's hard to imagine from a Western perspective, who we think it's always negative. But there was a time when you couldn't divorce, and all of a sudden you could. And so all these women who were being abused by their husbands were now free and could divorce. And so in fact, over a short period of time, divorce is actually a protective factor for suicide. Hard to imagine. 10 years later, it's neutral, and I expect 10 years from now, it will be a risk factor. So these risk factors that we think of universal actually are culture and time dependent. Religious affiliation. Because China, from revolution, is largely atheist, people who now are, and since Deng Xiaoping was allowed to participate in religion, the Christian and Catholic churches opened a lot more, particularly in urban areas, but the people who went to them weren't people who had three generations of religious beliefs. They were people who had problems, who were worried about things, and so they went to participate in religious activities. And in fact, people with religious affiliations in most countries are less likely to suicide. In China, they're more likely to have suicidal ideation. So these ideas of universal risk factors really need to be context and time dependent. And also, pesticide is by far the most common method of suicide. About 300,000 suicides a year out of the 880,000 are from pesticide, by far the most common method.
Michael Phillips, the director of the Suicide Research and Prevention Center at Shanghai Jiao Tong University School of Medicine. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Michael Phillips in a moment, 930, 94.9, KUOW. In the late 1970s and 1980s, tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union were high. Meanwhile, there was an unusual joint venture between West Coast fishermen and Russian fishermen. It's the subject of a new exhibit called Wild East Meets Wild West, opening Sunday at the Pacific Maritime and Heritage Center in Newport, Oregon. The story tomorrow during the noon hour. Support for KUOW comes from Christine Palmer and Associates, presenting antiques and collectibles shows for more than 30 years. The annual fall show is this weekend, November 9th and 10th, at the State Fair Events Center in Puyallup, with more than 400 booths featuring thousands of items for collecting and decorating.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Michael Phillips has lived and worked in China since 1985, when the Cultural Revolution ended. He's observed many changes in how the country offers mental health services, including how the stigma they often carry is starting to go away. Phillips spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15, 2013.
How important a role do mental illnesses and the treatment of mental disorders play in regional differences in suicide rates and in change in suicide rates over time in Asia Pacific? So what role is mental health? Well, this is a study from India that was published from the 1 million person death study in last year, Vikram Patel. And I just want to point out two things. This is male suicide rates by state, and the adjusted suicide rate in Kerala is 66. And in Bihar, it's 6.3, a tenfold difference. Well, it's hard to believe that there's a tenfold difference in mental illness or in treatment of mental illness. It just doesn't wash. You know, it's hard to say that mental illness rates or treatment rates are what's causing this degree of difference. In females, the difference is from 39.7 to 2.2, almost 20-fold different. Clearly, that suicide rates are not being, derived from this, that they're not being driven by mental illnesses. If they were, it would be impossible to explain such huge differences in rates. Also, you notice here that in one of the states, suicide rates in females is 14.9 and it's 7.9 in males, so it's twice as much. So that's another country that actually sometimes has higher rates in females, completely different from what's seen in the West. This is the suicide rates, you know, in America have been pretty stable over the last couple of decades, but in Korea, for example, they've gone up threefold over the last 20 years. At the same time, the suicide rates in China have dropped 50%. So have the people in China got that much better mentally ill and the Koreans got that much worse mentally ill? Not likely. It's unlikely that mental illness is driving these changes. It just doesn't wash. So the hypothesis is that in most low and middle income countries with large agricultural populations, patterns of pesticide use and access to pesticides are a more important determinant of the rates and demographic characteristics of suicide than prevalence and treatment rates of mental disorders. Now this is, again, hard to swallow for most suicidologists who think that the 1, 2, and 3 interventions for suicide is identify and treat high-risk people with mental illnesses. But if pesticides are the prime driver of suicide rates, maybe we should put a little more emphasis on decreasing access and lethality of these means. You know, that's for the bang for the buck, this is where we should be going. Not building more mental health centers, not providing better treatment for depression, at least in these countries. And we've done a project supported by the WHO of lockboxes. This is, we provided these types of boxes for storing pesticide in 10,000 households in a province, in two townships. And then this is two townships with like 50,000 people in the two townships, and you had control of 250,000. Place these 10,000 boxes in. And the intervention was 2010, so we compared 2009 to 2011, 2012 rates of suicide, attempted suicide, and everything. Percent change, in fact, the drop was higher of suicides, but this is a small number. The drop was substantially higher in attempted suicides, and this is significant. So this intervention of just providing places to lock up the pesticide so it's not freely available in home has had a substantial improvement in suicide rates. Now, there's concern, will there be replacement? In fact, in other countries, it's evident that there isn't replacement. So every country will need to make its own decisions about how it mobilizes and expends personnel, funds, and other resources for the prevention of suicide. But I believe that at this point in time, it's a serious mistake for China, India, and other low and middle income countries to expend 80% of the limited resources available for suicide prevention on individual-focused mental health approaches. But that's what's being recommended to these people. So there needs to be a rethinking, and Western models need to learn from what's happening in other countries. Another topic that has always been interesting to me was the rates of mental illness. Now, previously in China, there was a whole range of rates, overall rates of mental illness in the country, because they were using different methods. Initial two studies, Norman Sartorius worked with the present state exam, but this was a key informant method of identifying mental illness. And so they paid overall rates of 2 to 3%. And mental affective disorders, depression and mania, were like 0.2 to 0.3. Very low, unbelievably low. And people kept saying, why is there so little depression in China? Based on the 1990 global burden disease projections, the rates were 7. This was not actual epidemiological study. These are projections. And subsequent studies in the World Mental Health Survey using the CD, which is an interview done by students, not professionals, showed that in Beijing it was 9 and in Shanghai was 4. Now, of course, the Shanghai people loved that as a result. But it beggars imagination how there could really be a twofold difference in the rates of mental illness between Shanghai and Beijing. And so there are clearly methodological problems with the CD and the World Mental Health Survey generally. I have other complaints about that. So with the support of the China Medical Board, I conducted the largest psychiatric epidemiology study ever done in a single country. Combined 4 provinces. The sampling frame was 112 million people, about 12% of the adult population. We interviewed 63,000 individuals. So this was a really big study. And believe me, it was a lot of work. And what we found was that the rates of mental illness weren't all that different from what one sees in European and North American countries. Overall, it was 17%, mood disorder 6%, et cetera, et cetera. So it really kind of reset the mark. It highly questions the previous reports of very low rates of depression, for example. And there's a lot of question, well, does that mean because our study was a little later than the others, the rates of suicide of mental illness are going up dramatically? I don't think so. I think it's just that we had better methodology and somewhat more comprehensive. We used a SCID. There were psychiatrists who did the interviews. The one area where I think there is a substantial increase over time is substance abuse, particularly alcohol. But this is a rethinking of, in these low-income countries, if you do really high-quality, in-depth work, the rates don't seem to be all that different. At least in China, that's my experience. And now there's been another couple of follow-up studies that show similar rates. Other things that were important about the study was, for example, substance abuse, particularly alcohol, really seems to be different there than it is in the West. This is the rates by gender, and the adjusted ratio of male rates to female rates, it's 58 to 1 for alcohol use disorders, whereas in the U.S. it's 2.5 to 1. So it's a different phenomenon. The age of onset in China is 30. In the U.S., it's 20. So drinking in China is a different social phenomenon, and the illness related to drinking is a different social phenomenon. Also, the pattern of symptoms is different. The symptoms pattern to define alcohol use disorder is based on the diagnosis, the DSM-5 or DSM-4. And in China, like legal problems are supposed to be one of the core features of dependence, but you don't have those in China because it doesn't come up to the legal system. So using that as symptom clearly is inappropriate. Similarly, not from our study, but from other studies, the global adult tobacco study for China, the rates of smoking, daily smoking in females to females is 22 to 1. Again, and in the U.S. it's like 1.3 to 1. So it's a different, completely different pattern. Why is this important? Because in terms of the burden of illness, this says risk factors are relevant importance to overall health in China. Smoking, tobacco smoking is number 3, and alcohol is number 7. So these are very important public health problems in the country. But if we're trying to use Western models to understand them and treat them, we're going to go in the wrong directions. Because it's clearly a different phenomenon. And I think projecting data from Western countries to kind of look at what the pattern is, how we should intervene, it's clearly going to be wrong. Other things about this study, the rates of treatment, well, this is the rates of disability. So the different conditions have different proportions of people who are moderately to severely disabled. Unfortunately, the GBD stuff, it gives the same disability. You got depression, you got one disability measure, right? And then now, but in fact, there's varying disability. So that's one problem I have with the GBD results, because they give one weight for depression. And in fact, depression and other conditions have different weights. Their disability, their effect on health, their economic effect is going to be varied. So this is a refinement that I think we at the University of Washington can help the GBD stuff to kind of try and figure out. Also, the rates of treatment were very low in China. In total, overall, it's like 5% have seen a mental health worker and 3% have seen a non-health worker. So about 92% of people who have a current mental illness have never seen any type of psychological care, zero, in their lifetime. Now, that varies, of course, by condition, but that's clearly where we need to focus ourselves. So the question shouldn't be how many people have mental illnesses, but what proportion of those who meet the diagnostic criteria for mental illnesses have moderate to severe social or occupational disability due to the mental illness? Do these mental illnesses and their do those with mental illnesses and their family members know that they have a treatable condition? Are they willing to seek psychological treatment? What treatment services are available? Are their general doctors able to recognize and treat the disorders? And how affordable and effective are the available treatment? These are the important questions, not the numbers. And that raises the issue of how do we provide service to 173 million people in China? Because based on our rates, you've got 173 million people in China have current mental disorders. There's no way on earth in a million years you're going to have enough psychiatrists doing that. So it requires, to address this problem of this in China and in other low and middle income countries, requires a major redistribution of limited societal and health resources that will only occur with the active participation of powerful political, economic, social, and professional stakeholders in the community. We really got to mobilize a lot of resources to address this magnitude of problem. An effective promotion of mental health in low and middle income countries requires a detailed appreciation of the historical trajectory of political, social, economic, and health system changes in the country or region. You need a really detailed, sensitive situation analysis in a country to decide what can work and what can't work. There's often the belief, the somewhat simplistic belief in the West, that developing countries, they're going to follow the same trajectory as Western countries, just 20 years behind. They're delayed, but they'll follow the same trajectory for development services and health services in other areas. Well, this doesn't wash. Here's the number of psychiatrists per 100,000 population in the United States from 1956 to 2000. This is the number of beds. This is the number of psychiatrists per 100,000. So in the U.S., the number of beds dropped from 346 per 100,000 to 74. Huge deinstitutionalization movement. And China increased from 1.7 to 11.
Michael Phillips, the director of the Suicide Research and Prevention Center at Shanghai Jiao Tong University School of Medicine. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Michael Phillips in a moment, 944, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow evening, we'll get a look at the question of how such creatures as starlings, bees, and ants organize themselves into complex social structures without anyone or anything giving them any directions. Also, the bottom-up logic of cities, Google, and even our own brains. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Forecast says lows lower to mid-40s tonight, showers decreasing overnight. Friday highs around 50, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Support for KUOW comes from Evergreen City Ballet, presenting The Nutcracker, December 7th through the 22nd in three different venues. Clara and the Prince travel to the Land of Sweets, featuring mice that escape into the audience with falling snow and the Sugar Plum Fairy. Tickets at evergreencityballet.org. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Times and seattletimes.com, a news media company committed to reporting in a variety of formats, in print and on laptops, tablets, and smartphones. The Seattle Times, in print and online. Now more than ever, where life unfolds.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. China recently passed its first national mental health law. According to Michael Phillips, who's lived in the country since 1985, this is a huge step. China is listed as a country with one of the highest rates of suicide, and mental health services have carried a stigma for years. Phillips is the director of the Suicide Research and Prevention Center at Shanghai Jiao Tong University School of Medicine. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15, 2013.
The number of psychiatrists in the U.S. from 1956 to 2005 per 100,000 population changed from 4.6 to 13.3, about a four-fold increase, and China from 0.06 to 1.45. China is not going to start deinstitutionalizing now. China is not going to follow the U.S. pattern 20 years later. Each country has its own trajectory, and if you really want to do an intervention in another country, you've got to understand the trajectory, the incentive systems that are working with the stakeholders. Don't assume it's going to follow a pattern that's been seen elsewhere, because every country, the social forces that affect the development of services generally, and particularly mental health services, are multiple. And you really got to understand those if you want to roll out a program in another country. Okay, global mental health. So the situation in China kind of highlighted how important global mental health. We're going to get 173 million people with mental illnesses. We need a much broader focus than psychiatry and psychiatric hospitals. The WHO has developed the Mental Health Gap Program, which I was involved in partially, to address, particularly in rural areas of low-income countries. This program has set particular conditions as priorities, depression, suicide, psychosis, and so the goal is to provide services in low-resource settings. Where the WHO has now gone, so that's happened since 2008, so they've kind of been promoting that, and China, we're trying to do some of the global mental health gap stuff, but what's happened that's really exciting recently, as of May 27th, 2013, the World Health Assembly, this is all the ministers of health from around the world, got together and approved the Comprehensive Mental Health Action Plan for 2013-2020. This, 10 years ago even, this would have been science fiction to think that the ministers of health from around the world would support something in mental health with that degree of emphasis. It's fantastic for us who are working in this area. And here's their vision. A world in which mental health is valued, mental disorders are effectively prevented, and in which persons affected by these disorders are able to access evidence-based health and social care and exercise the full range of human rights to attain the highest possible level of health and functioning free from stigma and discrimination. Those are soaring words. I shiver when I read those words, because it isn't me who wrote it, it's the Minister of Health from around the world agreed to that. This is an opportunity for us who work in this area, that there's really, now is our time. We're at the big table. The World Health Assembly approved this. This is really big news from my perspective. Now, whether or not we can come across and actually find solutions to the problems, that's now our responsibility. But they've said this is important enough to get this level of recognition. And that's why we need global mental health centers. That's why we need to do other things to address, to achieve these goals. China has been up to date with this. China has just passed its first national mental health law. It passed it last year, and it was implemented May 1st this year. 27 years in the making, this mental health law is truly revolutionary. One is going to change mostly involuntary treatment to voluntary treatment. Previously, it was families who decided who got in a hospital. Now the individual has the right to decide to go or not, unless they're violent to others. Other unique components include sections on prevention and rehabilitation, financing and management services, provision of social welfare services of mentally ill, clarification of responsibilities of different government agents, etc., etc. Many of these goals are aspirational, but watch this page, because this is going to be, they're going to experiment in different provinces with this law, and they're going to learn an awful lot, will be extremely valuable both to other developing countries, and I expect many of the lessons they'll learn will also be useful to the international community in developed countries as well. In our journal, I'm the co-editor of this journal, Shanghai Arthritis Journal, which is the first all-English psychiatric journal in China. And all the articles in this now get translated in China. So we're delighted to have people, anybody wants to submit an article, be glad to have it. We're glad to have international content. But this is now a platform. So the law has been translated and annotated in this journal. You can get it on the web. And this is now a platform so for Westerners who want to speak to the Chinese professionals, most of whom never read English language journals, please send us your stuff. We'll be delighted to have it. And so there's now a platform to communicate between China and the international readership. It's also, the table of contents is published in the American Psychiatric Journal. So every time we have a new issue of the Shanghai Archives, the table of contents gets in the American Journal. So that's the collaboration we need cross-culturally, cross-nationally. And based on these initiatives, we've established the Shanghai Mental Health Center, Emory University Collaborative Center for Global Mental Health. So these types of collaborations between developed and developing countries are really essential to promote global mental health. Under this auspices, we're doing a project in Ningxia, which is a poor northern province, has lots of minorities, and we're doing a number of things. One is to adapting the WHO Mental Health Gap Program for rural areas in Ningxia. We've done studies on smoking under the auspices of the Global Mental Health Center. And this is something new. We're doing studies in factories in China. In China, there are 200 million factory workers who kind of rural kids who have come from the rural areas and working in factories. And the mental health of these people, nobody's focused on this prior to the suicides in Foxconn. It was sort of a non-issue. But we got, many other developing countries, India, Brazil, have huge numbers of often youth coming from rural areas into the urban areas to work in factory settings. And understanding the processes that affect their mental health is really essential. This is a target group that isn't of interest particularly to developed countries. We also have established a China-India Mental Health Alliance, kind of south-south relationship. Those two countries together account for 36% of the world population. So if we can, India is going to pass a new mental health law in the next couple of months. So comparing India's and China's will be really valuable for understanding different because, of course, India has been a democracy, China is not a democracy, and how has mental health evolved in those two different settings? So this alliance will hopefully work to answer some of those questions and provide models that could be used in other developing countries. So I'm going to end with some predictions for China. And first, let me make clear that predictions are predictions. This was the RAND's prediction in 1954 of the personal computer by year 2000. So, you know, take anything I say from here on with a substantial degree of salt. China recently already is the second most largest economy in the world, and it's recently pushing the envelope to be the largest trading world in the world. It's surpassing the United States. It's the largest trading country in the world. The day before the U.S. government closed down, Shanghai opened a new free trade zone that is probably going to be a new model for economic reform, like Shenzhen was when Deng Xiaoping did in 1980. It's opening banks, it's opening a lot of the restrictions on currency, et cetera, that have limited some development within China. Urbanization. As of 2010, China is now 50% urban. This is from 25% in 1988. That's an incredible rate of urbanization. And the GDP per capita in urban areas has increased like tenfold. In rural areas, increased fivefold. Now, the gap is getting larger, which is of concern, but it has pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And yes, there's a larger gap, but there's no question there's a lot fewer people below the poverty line who can't feed their kids kind of poverty in China now than there were 20 years ago. They've really got it. Internet penetration. Overall, nationally, it's about 42%, but it's 70% in urban areas, and rural areas already have 30% internet penetration. I mean, they're getting connected fast. And this, of course, has pluses and minuses, but information communication in China is lightning speed compared to what it was 10 years ago. Of course, this doesn't come without substantial negatives. The divorce rate has risen dramatically over this period. But you notice it's still like maybe 3 or 5%. So compared to the United States, it's still minuscule. But it is an increasing social problem. In health, the red line is the life expectancy birth in China. This is the red line. The yellow line is India. The blue line is Europe. The green line is the United States. This is 2010. look at this incredible increase in the life expectancy of China. Amazing. The epidemiologists look and they can't believe what China's done. And the recent global burn disease study showing that China had decreased its infant mortality rate at such a rate, it was just beyond belief. And they have done it. These are real numbers. The recent global burn disease study looking at HALE, which is healthy life expectancy, probably the best overall measure of health in a country, HALE at birth. These are males. China is the same as the United States. Females, China is the same as the United States. So already using this really important measure, the health of China is equivalent to that of America. In 2009, they decided the discrepancy between the urban and rurals was just too great. We have to do something about it. And so in a matter of 6 months, the government decided to commit $120 billion U.S. into rural health care. And over a result of this, this is $120 billion U.S., so 850 billion Chinese yuan, over those 3 years, over 1.3 billion people, 95% of the population, were covered by the end of 2011. In just 3 years, 172 new people were covered by insurance. 172 million people. Wow. Now, the level of coverage is quite low, but the structure's there, and as the money increases, they're providing drug benefits and some hospital benefits. So right now, it's quite low, but they've got basically, it's now up over 80, 98%. Basically, everybody's on insurance, and they've done that in 3 years. Of course, there are some downsides to this development. There's a lot of, the expectation has increased dramatically for what health providers should be doing, and there's now a negative side is you're getting defensive medicine because docs are trying to prevent medical legal complaints. And sometimes, to disabuse you of any idea about the reticence of Chinese, it can be quite dramatic. Now, all you need to do is go to a vegetable market in China for 15 minutes and see them argue about the price of carrots. And you know Chinese are very emotive. This idea of the reticent, quiet Chinese, that's a myth. I never believed in, boy, you go to a vegetable market a couple times, you know it's not true. So here's a person who's kind of unhappy about his medical treatment and goes and stabs a couple of nurses. So how unhappy he was. But the question is, what medical treatment? He stabbed three nurses in a hospital corridor after a chat with a doctor who had performed cosmetic surgery to plant hair in his chin to create a beard. Now, either he was a Red Sox fan or a Duck Dynasty wannabe, we don't know, but and that's what he's unhappy, so he responds dramatically. And that's one of the downsides of this expectation that the country is going to provide services. China's also moved ahead very quickly in science. They're planning to get somebody on the moon by 2020, and I think they'll do it.
Michael Phillips, the director of the Suicide Research and Prevention Center at Shanghai Jiao Tong University School of Medicine. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series on October 15, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from GET, Washington's Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, helping parents plan and save for college with flexible options, a nationwide choice of colleges, and backed by the state of Washington. Information and enrollment online at get.wa.gov. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Girls School, with an open house Saturday, November 9th. SGS is committed to empowering young women grades 5 through 8 to be leaders in their communities, with a program focused on collaboration, integration, and problem solving. More at seattlegirlsschool.org. 10 o'clock, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington, thanks to the wisdom and generosity of contributing listeners. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.